Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest,
Network Europe, a partnership of the continent's leading international broadcasters. Hello, Nick Champeau here, and a warm welcome to this edition of Network Europe. As usual, we've got loads of exciting reports coming your way. It's been a pretty busy week here on the continent, news-wise at least, with heavy overnight violence in Budapest. We'll discuss the issue at great length with our Network Europe reporter. Is it the end of the welfare state in Sweden? We'll go to Stockholm to find out, and we'll discuss the historical outcome of last weekend's elections. He is 78 years old, he is a convicted racist, and he thinks he can win. Jean-Marie Le Pen launches his fifth presidential campaign at the battle site of Valmy. All that and more in this week's Network Europe, so stay tuned. As promised, let's head straight to Budapest. The Hungarian capital was the scene of repeated overnight violence and demonstrations this week. These were prompted by what will probably go down in history as one of the worst gaffes made by a ruling politician. Socialist Prime Minister Ferenc Gyurcsány admitted in a behind-doors meeting that his government messed up and lied. That's actually a politically correct translation of what he said. The problem is that all of this was leaked to the press and led to demonstrations and riots. Now, Stephen Castle, Network Europe's EU insider and roving reporter, is on the line from Budapest. Stephen, we've had conflicting reports as to who the demonstrators are exactly. Police officials say they're far-right activists and hooligans. Commentators say they're just unhappy citizens. So, Stephen, you're there. You know who's right.
I think when you see some of the destruction that's been caused to central Budapest, really quite incredible scenes here in the week, you have to conclude that there is a hardcore of people here who are intent on causing some violence. Possibly these people come from the far right. Possibly, as the police have been saying all week, they're made up of football hooligans from the two main Budapest football teams who have, strangely seems to have united to take part in this protest. However, if you go into the main square opposite the parliament, as I have done over this week, and talk to the demonstrators, clearly these are not from that hardcore. These are mainly young people. Quite a lot of them are waving banners and flags, which would suggest they are perhaps more to the right and have more of a nationalist sympathy. But essentially, they are normal students, activists who are fed up with the government, fed up with the Prime Minister, and want him out of office.
So it's not just football hooligans and far-right supporters, as police officials seem to indicate. So as you said, you spoke to a number of these demonstrators. They're fed up, but what did they tell you exactly, and how far are they prepared to go?
They say they're prepared to go all the way. They're prepared to continue demonstrating. They've been demonstrating, let's not forget, since Sunday when a few hundred initially gathered outside the parliament. This has now grown to thousands. I spoke to one 19-year-old student who said, what we need here is a proper revolution. The question really, though, is whether there is going to be any effective leadership to this protest, which will focus it. Interestingly, the main opposition party, Fidesz, hasn't really emerged as the organizing force behind it. And one of the reasons to explain that is the economic situation here. Hungary is heading for a budget deficit of over 10% of its GDP. That will be the worst in the entire European Union. And any politician that comes into power now is going to have very tough choices. They're going to have to impose an austerity package, and that's going to make them very unpopular.
And that's why the socialist prime minister decided to raise taxes and cut expenses, which is not exactly what he promised during his campaign for a re-election, which is another reason for discontent in Hungary, I understand. Now, Stephen, do you think he has enough support to survive the crisis?
I think in the short term he has enough political support in Parliament to survive any potential no-confidence motion. That seems pretty clear. What isn't so clear is whether he can survive continuing protests. If he has a whole month of protests continuing and building, then I think that would put him in an extremely difficult position. And Yorcan, you have to remember, is an extremely divisive figure in Hungary. To his supporters, he's a hero. He restored the socialists to office, and he managed to get them re-elected. But to his opponents, he really is the epitome of everything they despise about their past, because not only was he a member of the old regime, he was part of the Young Communist League before the fall of the Soviet Union, but he then really did extremely well financially out of the transition into the new capitalist world. He made several property deals which have made him a millionaire. And that makes it rather difficult for Yorcan, this wealthy former communist, to impose tax increases on people who are considerably less well off than he is.
Stephen Castle, Network Europe's EU insider, reporting from the riots in Budapest. Thank you very much indeed. Now, what did Hungary's socialist prime minister say exactly? His leaked comments have sparked off the riots, but what are the other reasons for discontent in Hungary? The answers with Radio Romania's Cristina Cucioreanu.
Nem csináltunk semmit négy évig. Semmit. Végig hazudtuk az utolsó másfél két.
We did not do anything for 4 years. Nothing. We have obviously been lying for a year and a half now. It is perfectly clear that what we were saying was not true. This is an excerpt from the famous, or rather infamous, speech that has made the headlines of most European media this week. Prime Minister Ferenc Gyurcsány delivered it at a Socialist Party meeting back in May. He says it was meant to convince his party members of the need for major economic reform. But the tape leaked and was posted on the website of the Hungarian radio, sparking protests on the streets of Hungary's capital, Budapest. Demonstrators gathered outside the parliament building and demanded Prime Minister Gyurcsány to step down. The irrefutable evidence of his lies, coupled with his tough budget reforms, have angered Hungarians, who are struggling to cope with tax increases, layoffs and rising energy prices.
It's very hard to live on a small income while politicians in parliament are earning millions. I live on the equivalent of 300 euros a month with my son, who is unemployed. I have to be very careful with every cent I spend.
I'm here demonstrating because even today it's still the communists who are ruling the country. People are disappointed and bitter. A third of the residents are unemployed, retired or alcoholic.
Gyurcsány's socialist-liberal coalition won general elections in April this year, and was the first government to be re-elected since the fall of communism in 1989. The cabinet leader is now vowing to continue reforms in order to rein in the skyrocketing deficit. Despite growing pressures from both protesters and the political opposition, the Prime Minister said he would not step down. But with local elections due on October 1st, the leaked tape scandal couldn't have come at a worse time. Gyurcsány is still backed by his socialist-liberal coalition, but that might change should voters turn against them at the polls. It may not be long before the Prime Minister sees just how far a lie can take him.
Radio Romania's Cristina Cucioreanu. Now to Sweden, where voters have sent the Social Democrats into opposition in last weekend's general elections. Swedes normally refuse to go right, of the political spectrum, that is. The Social Dems have been in the driving seat for most of the last 80 years, but this time apparently they thought it was time for a change. Fredrik Reinfeldt, the leader of the center-right coalition and next prime minister, is working to form a new government, which is due to take power on the 5th of October. I'm joined by Radio Sweden's Mark Cummins, who's on the line from Stockholm. Mark, you have reactions from ordinary people, I believe.
Yes, we do. We were out in the streets of Stockholm on Monday morning just to see what the reaction was, as we knew from Sunday night it had been a neck-and-neck race really throughout the whole campaign. But on the last night, on Sunday night, it was really 50-50 until about 10 o'clock. Well, just before 11 o'clock, actually, was is the first time that it became clear that we were going to see a shift of government. So we went out on the streets to see what people thought and if they were as surprised actually as we were.
So let's hear what they have to say.
I think Sweden needs a new government with new ideas and some new people. Yeah, we need a change.
I'm very happy. I think it was a good timing now to change the government, definitely.
What are your expectations?
Well, we want more jobs. That is the main reason.
It's terrible. It's a terrible day for Sweden. I didn't vote for them, so no, this is not something that I wanted.
What are you scared of?
I'm scared of a Sweden where the rich people get more money and the poor people get less money. That's what I'm scared of.
Well, I hope and I think that they will absolutely, we have to give them time, but I am convinced that they will give more people work and get more people engaged so they can go out and have work and lower taxes, for example.
That's what people in the streets of Stockholm expect from the new government. So it's mainly more jobs, but some fear this will mean more money for rich people, and that's all. So Mark, what does the new government have in mind for the so-called Swedish model? Because your welfare state is always referred to as an efficient model, a model envied in the rest of Europe. Will it suffer now that the centre-right is in power?
Well, I think that's actually one of the reasons why the centre-right alliance was able to get past the winning post, so to speak. What they've been able to do over the past 4 years, but especially over the past 2 years, is really convince the electorate that they actually believe in Sweden's welfare model and that they don't want to dismantle it as they've actually traditionally been seen to want to do. What they've been telling the electorate throughout the campaign is that we believe in the Swedish model and that we're going to keep the Swedish model, but what the Swedish model needs right now is to be updated, or it needs to be twinked somehow so that we'll work into the 21st century. And of course, Sweden and Swedes are, of course, aware that Sweden has this demographic shock that's coming. Sweden is aging very quickly, and that the model that has worked until now doesn't really have a future. A way has to be found to finance the welfare state, and that's what the centre-right alliance said that they will be able to do with the platform that they were talking about through the all throughout the campaign.
And obviously, Mark, the results are a blow to the Social Democrats because, as you said, they're not used to being in opposition. What did they do wrong? They didn't say that they had messed up and lied to Swedes for years and years like in Hungary, did they?
No, that they didn't do. You're right, though. It is a historic loss for the Social Democrats. They actually ran their worst election since 1914. On the other hand, it was actually the best election result for the moderate party since 1928, so it was historical in that way as well. Some of the theories that are now been handed around or discussed in media is that, one, that the party seems to have lost, or at least was perceived to have lost touch with the electorate, and that was personified in perhaps the Prime Minister, Göran Persson, who was seen to have not really been on top of what were the big issues in this election, and that was, of course, jobs.
So jobs topped the agenda, foreign policy didn't, but what does the new centre-right government have in mind with regards to relations with the EU? What should we expect from them?
You're right. Foreign policy didn't really figure at all in the debate. That was something that we talked about here at Radio Sweden, of course. Having said that, we do know that the four alliance parties are all very EU positive. I think what we will see and the indication that we've had is that Fredrik Reinfeldt will be a much more proactive actor in the European Union. Something that I've seen that's been interesting that's been mentioned in foreign media over the past week has been that different parties in different countries within Western Europe and the European Union will be looking at Sweden to see how it does tweak its model. I think that through that, Fredrik Reinfeldt and his new government might actually have quite a bit of pondus when it comes to reforming the welfare state and trying to energize Europe's economy. So that might be something that we see there.
Mark Cummins, managing editor of English programming at Radio Sweden and active member of the Network Europe team, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Network Europe. And now to France. This week, the leader of the National Front, Jean-Marie Le Pen, announced he would run in the country's next presidential elections in spring, his fifth bid for the presidency. The 78-year-old controversial leader made the announcement from the battlefield of Valmy, a key site in the history of the French Revolution. The question is, will Le Pen, notorious for his racist and revisionist remarks, succeed in presenting himself as a Republican? And can he capitalize on his breakthrough into the second round of the country's presidential elections 4 years ago? Radio France International's Hannah Godfrey reports from Valmy.
The sound of National Front supporters singing the strains of the Marseillaise as Jean-Marie Le Pen announces his candidacy for next year's presidential elections, taking the French Revolution for backdrop. He chose Valmy, a French national symbol, to launch his campaign. Valmy's the site where, on the 20th of September 1792, the French revolutionary forces halted the Prussian advance. The day after the victory, the National Convention announced the end of the monarchy. In a half-hour-long speech, the founder and leader of the French far-right party used the consensual and patriotic associations of the revolution to forward his familiar but ever-popular themes.
I have come to announce that a new Valmy is before us, with new threats, new challenges, and new hopes, so that French history, forged by the likes of Vercingetorix, Saint-Louis, and de Gaulle, can continue, or else she will disappear, annihilated, swallowed up in the Euro-Atlanticist magma. United like the valiant soldiers of Valmy, she will conquer the hostile forces that have come to bring her down. By a simple vote, she may give up her soul to the enemy army of globalized liberalism, of ghettoization, of uncontrolled immigration and regression. Et de la
régression. Le Pen has a history of associating himself with French national symbols, and this raises many hackles. On the day of Le Pen's visit to Valmy, the socialists, communists and Greens staged a protest against the National Front's appropriation of the revolution.
Les thèses que soutient Le Pen sont à l'opposé des thèses républicaines. La révolution française.
According to Jacques Meyer, the socialist general secretary for the Marne, where Valmy is situated, Le Pen's ideas are diametrically opposed to those of the Republic. He says the revolutionaries held that all men are equal, regardless of their race and religion. To which Jean-Marie Le Pen replies,
"Our choice on the Valmy place is justified by the desire to prove that we are really a Republican force, not only for the defense of the national interest, but also for the defense of the principle of the French Republic. We take all the history of France, not only a part or another part, we take all the history for us."
On the 21st of April 2002, shockwaves ran through France and beyond when Le Pen broke into the second round of the presidential ballot. But what are his chances in next year's elections? At the age of 78, he doesn't have age on his side. During his speech at Valmy, he made a number of slips of the tongue, and at the following press conference, he had great difficulty hearing the journalists' questions. His trump card is the simple course of history. The events of the past 4 years have played in his favour. Last year's riots and the great waves of immigrants that are landing on Europe's southern coast are for many like the fulfilment of the prophecies Le Pen has been intoning throughout his political career. His appearance at Valmy was the return to the public stage of a man who's been waiting in the wings, keeping a low profile and rubbing his hands as one after the other the country's politicians adopt positions on immigration and security that were traditionally associated with his party. Whether it will be him or, ironically, one of his adversaries who will benefit from this turn of events will be revealed in the spring.
RFI's Hannah Godfrey reporting from Valmy. And now to Poland. Polish authorities have declared they will send 1,000 soldiers to Afghanistan as part of a NATO multinational force. Not a real surprise. The decision is, to a certain extent, a logical consequence of the country's support for American-led operations in the war on terror. But for the first time, the national consensus on Poland's role in such missions seems to have been broken. with the opposition accusing the government of sending Polish troops into combat rather than a peacekeeping mission. Radio Polonia's Sławek Chefs reports.
What surprised the Law and Justice government coalition partners had been the lack of consultations on the decision concerning the scope of Polish participation in the NATO-Afghan mission, as well as its character and duration. The operation will cost Polish taxpayers some 75 million euros, and for the first time, Polish troops would be engaged in direct combat and not peacekeeping duties. Another serious reservation, and not only of ruling coalition members, has been the place and time this decision was announced. Opponents were quick to claim that the Prime Minister's working visit to the United States and Washington have not been the best choice, if only for the sake of reactions and comments. But these, at least on the part of top American officials, such as Chairman of the House of Representatives Dennis Hastert, has been very positive.
We had a very cordial discussion. We talked about how we're working together, common responsibilities that we have against fighting terrorism in the world. Poland is a very strong ally and a good friend.
President Lech Kaczyński, the Prime Minister's twin brother, also sees no harm in this Polish pledge and fully supports the decision.
We've been in Afghanistan, Iraq. We are and will be present in even greater numbers in Lebanon. Polish soldiers are in Congo, the Golden Heights, and the Balkans. Such is Poland's policy, and it didn't start with my term in office or the government of Kazimierz Marcinkiewicz and then Jarosław Kaczyński. It's a continuation of earlier policies.
Still, former President Lech Wałęsa has been critical of the government decision.
I've always had a different concept. The world is badly organized. It needs global structures. Under the circumstances, I'd manage a different solution.
As of February next year, 1,000 Polish troops will be stationed in Bagram and operating in the eastern parts of Afghanistan under direct NATO command. The duration of their combat mission against the Taliban has initially been set for 1 year, but experts are certain it will last much longer. Jaap de Hoop Scheffer, NATO Secretary General, was extremely pleased upon hearing the news from Washington on the Polish declaration.
We can do more with more forces, so it is important, this Polish decision, to answer the quest for more forces in Afghanistan. This is a very important operation for NATO. It is NATO's first priority, and we are doing well.
Wojciech Łuczak, editor of the Raport military magazine, reminds of ideas outlined by former Polish decision-makers and points to their continuation being a reflection of NATO concepts.
That was something like a policy declared during the last coalition government that the Polish presence in Iraq should be dramatically decreased and in favor of Afghanistan, in favor of NATO-led mission, because everybody should understand that we are in Iraq as American allies, not as allies of the alliance, Euro-Atlantic alliance, but as American allies. The former NATO Secretary Lord Robertson and current NATO Secretary asked many times about increasing the European military presence of European NATO members for such an important mission like Afghanistan. It's a creation of something like security and safe zones for developing the new future.
Not questioning the validity of the very idea of participation in the NATO operation in Afghanistan, a common sense balance of Polish forces in Iraq and Afghanistan is what both the junior government coalition partners and opposition have been calling for. It remains to be seen whether a suitable solution can be found.
Radio Polonia's Sławek Chefs. And now to Bucharest. Romania and its neighbor Bulgaria will most probably join the European Union on January the 1st, 2007. Many Romanians support membership because it will allow them to work and gain experience abroad, preferably in the UK. But Radio Romania International's Julian Morishan says they may be a bit disappointed there.
Romania is one of the poorest countries to join the European Union. Its GDP amounts to 30% of the EU average. The prospects of higher earnings and a legal status as migrant workers after accession make the United Kingdom a very attractive labour market for Romanians and Bulgarians. Just like the more than 200,000 Poles who have registered for work in the UK in the last 2 years, Romanians are very well appreciated by their employers. Eugen Urcan has been working in Ireland for 7 years.
I can tell you that Irish people are so satisfied, happy with Romanian workers, because Romanian workers are working very hard but very well. The competition will be higher and the price, the cost, less for them.
In recent weeks, there have been lots of debates in the UK about the impact of the potential inflow of Romanians and Bulgarians on the British labour market after these countries joined the EU, most probably in January 2007. Despite voices from the business community in the UK which advocate an open doors policy, it seems that there's a strong case amongst cabinet ministers to impose restrictions on Romanian and Bulgarian workers seeking jobs to Great Britain after accession. Romanians and Bulgarians follow 3 years after the 8 East European countries that joined the bloc in 2004. In the last 2 years, these countries have exported more than 400,000 workers to Great Britain, and this figure is 20 times higher than initially estimated. A spokesman for the UK Department for Work and Pensions told me that the 8 countries that joined the Union in 2004 have had a broadly positive effect on the British labour market. But the chairman of Migration Watch UK, Sir Andrew Green, fears that 200,000 Romanians and 80,000 Bulgarians estimated to seek work in Great Britain might be more than the UK can take.
What is clear is that the numbers are very large and they are starting to have an impact on employment and also on housing. So there is some concern in Britain that the total flow of immigration is already too high. So our view would be that any additional immigration from Romania and Bulgaria should be postponed. That is to say that we should apply transitional arrangements in accordance with the treaties, as has been the case for most countries in Europe, in respect of the first 8 new members.
The plans by British ministers to introduce a work permit scheme to restrict the number of Romanians and Bulgarians seeking jobs in the UK have triggered the reaction of Romanian President Traian Băsescu, who said Romanians will not be treated as second-class citizens of the EU. He also warned countries that choose to apply this system that Romania will apply similar measures to their citizens. However, President Băsescu is known to like popularity, and few actually believe it will ever come down to that. The Home Office in London is reserved. They are still analysing the matter while postponing any decision. According to their spokesman, a final decision will be made once Romania's accession date is confirmed, and that might happen on September the 26th, when the European Commission is due to publish a decisive monitoring report on Romania and Bulgaria's preparedness for EU accession.
Radio Romania's Iulian Mureșan reporting from Bucharest. And that's almost all we have time for on this week's edition of Network Europe. For me, Nick Champeau, it's goodbye and thanks for joining us. And thanks to studio producer Mariana Ioan and sound engineer Céline Grassin de Lille. If you'd like to listen to this program again or to previous editions of Network Europe, please visit our website, the address networkeurope.org. That's networkeurope.org. And you can also subscribe to our podcasts on the site. We'll leave you with music and a British band called the Pipettes. Three female musicians who have a lot of energy and certainly a lot of success here in Europe. And this track is called Pole Shapes. Have a wonderful weekend. Bye-bye.